Thank you. Well, thank you very much for inviting me to get this talk and also for hosting our program in general. We really enjoy our visit here and our time here working together. So it's been a very enjoyable process so far, and I expect it will continue to be. So I'm going to try and give you a bit of an overview of the Earth's mantle. And I'm not going to try and teach you everything you could ever possibly want to know about the Earth in an hour, because that would be talking faster than I can talk. But I do want to give you, so I want you to take away from my talk is, what I want you to take away from my talk is a sense of at least a few of the interesting problems that we're working on and why we are taking an integrated approach to understanding the Earth's interior. And so I will try and introduce you to a sort of select number of problems that are of interest to us, the people who are working on the mantle. But I thought it might be a good idea just to start by getting everybody oriented, since I think we have people working over probably 30 or more orders of magnitude of space and time. Getting the sort of magnitude right gets kind of iffy to start with. So first I'm just going to draw the Earth. Okay, so we start with basically the Earth, and just locate us as to where we want to be. And you can, if you're not used to thinking about the Earth at all, you can think of it as being like an egg with a shell and an egg white and an egg yolk, a spherical egg. That's a good concept. But it's a little bit more complicated than that. And so basically, this is not too bad proportionally, a picture of the cross-section of the Earth. We are standing on the crust. And the crust from the point of view of the sort of, the crust is very interesting to us because that's where we live, but it's not volumetrically a very significant part of the mantle. And so basically, if I were going to draw it to scale, especially in the oceans, it would be thinner than the piece of, than the line of the chalk. So I have to basically exaggerate this. And then underneath the crust, we have about almost 3,000 kilometers of region that we call the mantle. And this is the part that is going to be the focus of my talk today. So I'm just going to orient you towards the rest of it, and then we'll basically spend today talking about this region. And then you may have heard of the core, so that's the remaining part, and this is the outer core and the inner core. Which is a little bit more than, the core is a little bit more than half the radius of the Earth. So it's a significant, I think this would be rather quite proportional, but it's a little bit more than half the radius of the Earth. So just to get you kind of thinking about this region of the Earth's mantle, the surface of the Earth on which we live has rocks, mineral structures, and so on. And so does the mantle. The mantle is basically a solid material. If you picked up a piece of it, you would recognize it as a solid. It would look like a rock to you. It has a crystalline structure. It's not primarily molten, although there are little bits of melt here and there. The core, but it has some odd compositions. The core, on the other hand, would look very, very different, very unusual. The core is primarily iron with some other lighter elements, iron and nickel. The outer core is liquid. You would recognize it as a liquid. It would have a viscosity, something like water, maybe. But it's molten iron, so it's got electromagnetic properties of interest. And this is the region from which the magnetic field comes. So a lot of people are interested, a lot of physicists are interested in the origins of the magnetic field, and they spend their time studying the core. And then when you get to very high elevated pressures at the inner core, the material becomes solid again. It's still primarily iron nickel alloy, but it's primarily solid. So this part of the Earth is a very interesting exotic place, but it's not going to be the subject of my talk today. Okay? Instead, we're going to concentrate on this part of the Earth, the mantle, the solid silicate mantle. So it's solid, as I said, but at the same time, it's under very elevated pressures and temperatures. And under those very elevated pressures and temperatures, the rock experiences stress, and under those stresses, it doesn't really break, it instead flows. And so we can treat that flow, the creeping flow, as if the mantle is made of viscous material. So even though we think of it as a solid on some time scales, when we are dealing with geologic time scales, we treat this as if it's a fluid, a very, very, very viscous fluid. And that's going to give rise to some of the dynamical processes that we're interested in. So I realize this is completely introductory for the geophysicists in here, and maybe not so introductory for the other folks. So we basically have the effect of pressure allows this creeping mechanism to happen. Now, probably all of you have heard of the concept of plate tectonics. You're probably aware that the surface of the Earth is covered by a series of tectonic plates which move around relative to each other. And in fact, here in California, that gives rise to all sorts of interesting phenomena like earthquakes. And around the world, it gives rise to earthquakes, volcanic activity, kind of all the geological excitement that we experience. And that's because we're sitting right up next to a plate boundary. But from the point of view of the mantle, sorry,
the best way. Okay. Oops. Well, the introductory portion is lost a little bit. Ah, see if I can clip this. There we go. Okay. There's a compositional distinction. You can think of the crust as being, like if you made a pot of, the classic analogy that we use is if you make a pot of soup and you get the sort of scummy stuff on the top, that's the crust. There's a compositional difference that results from the very small amounts of melting that occur that tend to extract the things that like to melt, and they tend to go up into the crust. And over time, we've developed a crust as a result of that. So, okay. From the point of view of the mantle, from the point of view of the mantle, these tectonic plates are basically a boundary layer. So I'm going to draw them in like this as a boundary layer, and I'm going to draw it as variable thickness. I'm going to draw them in as sort of floating into the interior in some places, like that. This is a kind of cartoonish sketch. And you should think of that as having a scale of about 100 kilometers-ish, approximately. All these things are sort of approximated scale. And so from my point of view, I work on the problem of geodynamics. The interesting thing is what happens, how do these plates at the surface relate to the processes of in the interior. Okay, so before I get into that, I'm just going to briefly outline some of the disciplines, the ways we approach understanding the interior. So I've actually already given you a certain amount of information about the crust, the mantle, and the core. And I haven't really said anything about what we know or how we know what we know about this. So we can't go into the interior of the Earth. We have to study it by remote methods. We can only make the observations that we can make on the surface. And this is actually very challenging for us, and it's actually one of the reasons that we have workshops like this to try and integrate the different approaches. So there are four primary kind of modes of attack represented, if you want. One of them, and the most field that's provided us this sort of information about the bulk structure, is seismology. Basically, whenever there's an earthquake, seismic energy propagates through the interior of the Earth, and it's recorded at sensors, seismometers, and basically the rate at which those waves and the paths that they travel through the Earth gives us some information about the interior. So those of you who are here for the cardiac thing should probably be familiar with some of these same concepts, because a lot of the same concepts are used in medical imaging. You send a wave through something and you can image what the interior of a structure is that you don't want to or you're not able to break open. So a lot of the concepts of CAT scans and so on, the same mathematics are used in studying the interior of the Earth. A major difference for us between the study of medical imaging and the study of the Earth, there's sort of two main differences for us. One is that in medical imaging, the technology can be designed to look for what you want to look for. So the technician can control where the source is and where the sensors are. But in the Earth, we don't really have as much control. The Earth provides us with the energy through earthquakes. And basically, those earthquakes are limited in geographic regions. So you may be familiar with the concept of the Ring of Fire around the Pacific Rim. That's where a lot of the earthquakes are in the Earth. And that's where the information comes from. Likewise, sensors, in theory, we can put anywhere on the Earth. But in practice, logistically, it's much more difficult to put them at the bottom of the ocean than it is on land. And so largely, sensors are restricted to land, and largely they're restricted to countries where there's been enough funding to put them on land, and so they're largely restricted to the northern hemisphere and to the developed world. And so one of the tasks that that we have is to try and gather information from these sort of sources and receivers where we don't have a full, we don't get to control all the information. So our resolution is not always optimally what we would like it to be. So that's one thing about the seismic information. The other thing to keep in mind is that I said that the scales here are very large, 3,000 kilometers. The time scales for this creeping flow are very, very slow. So the motion of the creeping flow that's occurring, the motion of the plates that's occurring at the surface of the Earth, is occurring at rates of maybe 5 to 10 centimeters per year. This is a very small number. And what that means is that the interior structure doesn't change very much over time, over the human time scale in particular. And so although over geologic time, it does. But what you know, we've only had seismology for 100 years or so, so we really only have information in what amounts to a snapshot of the Earth. We know a snapshot, a kind of fuzzy snapshot of the Earth. Yes?
Perhaps I missed it, but under the plates,
They move with the mantle. The whole system is moving. It's overturning. So if I were going to draw lines of flow, I might draw them something like that. Right?
But you just said the mantle is solid.
It's solid. Mm-hmm. But it flows. So you can think of other things that seem like solids on an everyday basis, but actually flow. Glass is one of those things.
You also said it was crystal.
Yes, that's right.
Crystals can flow?
Yes, they can flow. They flow basically because they are imperfect. They have imperfections in them, dislocations, and those can, under deviatoric stress, basically under differential stress, they migrate, and that on, when you sort of take that process from the microscopic scale to the macroscopic scale, it amounts to moving the material around and causing it to flow. Yeah. Did that answer your question? Okay. So yes, that flow is happening. I was going to list a few time scales for you, but that's one of them. So basically, the time scales that we're interested in, the processes that we're interested in, are happening on the scale of millions of years to billions of years. So we're operating at, 30 orders of magnitude larger timescales than the attosecond folks in the room. So, and at many orders of magnitude different timescale than the cardiac people, maybe similar timescales to the galactic dynamics folks, so in terms of long, long timescales. And that represents a challenge to us. Okay, so this is one source of information. We obviously would like to have other sources of information. In particular, we'd like information about the time, about what happens, the evolution through time. And we do have that information. A lot of that information comes from geologists, basically from people going out and seeing how the Earth has changed through time telling us about the evolution, for instance, of where the plates were over time. From the point of view of the mantle, we have some information about the time evolution because we have samples of rocks from the interior that come up at volcanic, at spots where there's volcanism, and so that's very useful to us. And so I'm not going to try and give you the whole thing, I'm just going to give you a few highlighted bits of information, selected bits of information that are going to try and help you understand the problems that we're working on. I were just going to sort of draw a quick, I'm going to sketch a map. Okay, so that's like North America, kind of. California. There's South America. I can't do Europe very well. There's Africa. Pretty rough. But basically, you get the gist of that. There's Santa Barbara, KITP, right there. So we have, basically, if we were to draw, I'm just going to draw one of the plate boundaries. One of the plate boundaries comes down the center of the Atlantic. It's called the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. It's basically where one set of plates are moving that way and another set of plates are moving that way. And if you look a map of the ocean floor without the oceans on it, you would see this as a very gently elevated region that looks like a zipper in, or like the seam of a baseball, something like that. And it curves around a little bit, probably slightly more than I've just drawn it. These mid-ocean ridges are the places where two plates are pulling apart, and they are the source of most of the volcanic activity on the surface of the Earth today. So there's a lot of eruption of material, and so that provides us information about the interior of the planet. So we have a lot of samples taken at great effort from these places, and then we have some other volcanoes. Oops, too far north. Some other volcanoes here and there. No, too far north, and a few others here. Yes.
At any time, is just as much stuff coming up as is going down?
Yes. Conservation of mass applies. Conservation of...
It could be ripping up in mountains or something.
Oh, yeah. Just to a little bit of extent, it is. But basically, basically as much is coming up as is going down. There has to be... Yes. Yeah. There has to be conservation of area of the plates, basically, to first order and second order even. So essentially, that's actually one of the ways that people reconstruct the plate motions, is they know, we have a lot of information, as you can imagine, again, in some geographic regions, and not so much information in other geographic regions. But to some extent, you can create a kind of closed circuit if you know what all the plate motions are in, you know, if you know almost all the plate motions, you can fill in the rest by just making sure they all match up like a puzzle piece. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have some information about the interior because the Earth, and again, the Earth provides us these, it provides us volcanoes. We don't get to choose where they are, right? This is a natural system. We have to observe what we can. And so we have some information about the interior of the Earth. And that helps us in the following sense, because we have some time-integrated information. So I'm just going to mention a couple of things that give us some time-integrated information. There are a few important radioactive elements in the Earth, radioactive isotopes in the Earth, that are really critical for us to understand the interior. One of those is the isotopes of uranium, which decay to isotopes of lead. And these isotopes of uranium actually provide some heat that drive the flow, and I'll get into that in a second. Another is isotopes of thorium that decay also to lead. Another is some of the the rare earth elements, these very small, they're in very small abundances. Rubidium decays to strontium, and so on. There are a few handful of things that decay over time from radioactive isotopes to stable isotopes. And they decay on time scales that have half-lives of somewhere less than a billion to maybe 10 or 50 billion years. So the half-lives are similar in order to the age of the Earth. And that allows us to use those as essentially a time-integrated signal. The buildup of the daughter elements and the decay of the parent elements provides us information about how the Earth has evolved over time. So that's very handy. So there are lots of radioactive elements in the universe. Not all of them are useful to us in this quest for information about the mantle. Only the ones that are abundant enough, but not too abundant, and the ones that have the half-life that is of the scale similar to the processes that we're interested in are useful to us. So
there is no influx of uranium to Earth from anywhere. So all uranium that we have here is all the same.
It's what we started with, yes.
Okay.
I mean, there's the occasional impact. There's the occasional impact, but really not. There's no real influx. So,
how that can provide any information?
It provides information because the processes that produce melting also tend to separate out the parent and the daughter elements. And so, the processes that produce these melts, and in particular, the processes that there are many processes involved. The processes that produce the continental crust tend to concentrate some elements more than other elements. So there is this compositional mediastinum. There's this compositional difference, and that includes putting most of the uranium in the crust and leaving the mantle depleted of uranium. And so what that means is that over time, basically we've been pulling out the uranium and leaving behind the lead. You can think about how this might work. And realize that 238 uranium goes uranium goes to 206 lead, right? Okay, so if I have a lot of 206 lead in my reservoir, that means it had uranium, a lot of this uranium in it over time. If I have very little of this 206 lead, it means that I pulled out the uranium. And since there's a time scale associated with this, I can basically create a model system that allows me to study how long this has been, if something's high in 206 lead, how long it's been high in 206 lead, how long it was high in uranium. Does that make sense? Okay. Yeah.
What is the concentration of uranium if it's the source of heat?
It's very small. Parts per million in the whole Earth? What's the chondritic?
20
parts per billion in the whole Earth. The Earth is really big. If you add it all up, it's really big. Yeah, that's the reason the Earth is big and rock is not a very good conductor. So basically that heat does build up. So the various radioactive elements are generating currently about 20 terawatts of heat currently. And you know, it's basically comparable to the amount that humans generate, more or less, in terms of our power usage. But it's generating about 20 terawatts, and it was double that 3 billion years ago. So even more 3 billion years ago. It's just because if you just add it all up, it just is huge. Yeah. So, okay. So I hope that wasn't too confusing there, but in any case, so the reason I mention these things is because basically what we have, anytime we pick up a sample of a volcanic material, it gives us some information about the time integrated history of that sample. If it's high in this lead isotope, that means it came from a source that was high in uranium for a long period of time. If it's low in this, it came from a source that was low in uranium. And so we can actually look at the distribution of these, we can look at these volcanic sources and look at how they're distributed. And we can get some information.
This is assuming there was no lead 206 in the beginning?
No, I'm actually glossing over a part of this, which is that there's a stable isotope of lead. Stable in the sense that these are all stable, but this is not a daughter product of any of these decays. And so what we typically do is normalize everything to us. So what we typically do is not measure this, but measure this. And that allows us to distinguish between the original source and later sources. And everything that's done this way is always normalized to some kind of stable isotope to allow that to happen. Yeah, that's a very good question. Okay. So, the crash course in geochemistry. In fact, actually, one of the people who was giving a talk earlier pointed out that this is actually very different from the chemistry that we're taught in college, because we are sort of taught in college that lead should behave as lead should behave as lead, and all the different elements should behave the same. But what we're talking about is processes that basically create differences in these individual isotopes, and that allows us to detect differences in the interior of the Earth. Okay, so without going into detail about all of this, what I want to do is summarize what we know. To some extent, what we know about the interior from these things, and very, very briefly, we know that for instance, the uranium is concentrated in the continental crust, and that the mantle, this part that we're interested in, is depleted in those heat-producing elements. But we know that it's not depleted evenly. We also know that if we look along the mid-ocean ridges, which are randomly sampling the upper part of the mantle, just randomly kind of selecting bits of the upper mantle, that it's pretty uniform in the distribution of these various isotopes. So we know that some part of the mantle is pretty well mixed. But at the same time, I mentioned these other volcanoes, and I kind of put dots on here. This is meant to represent Hawaii. This is meant to represent Iceland. There are a few places on the planet where volcanism happens which messes with our plate tectonic view of the world. And it happens in places where it oughtn't to happen. So it's pretty easy to sort of characterize how pulling apart the plates and hot material coming up from the interior, it starts to melt, and then it basically erupts, and that's a nice consistent story. But then from time to time we have, either in the middle of a plate, like Hawaii, we have a volcano. And we have a series of volcanoes. And then in other places like Iceland, which sits basically on a plate boundary, we have so much volcanism that it's no longer below the ocean floor. It basically piles up enough to make an island. And these are anomalous. And so they have a name. They're called hot spots because they're anomalous. So we think that these actually may have a deeper source. That's the kind of current belief in this, that these have a deeper source than these ridges which are sampling the upper mantle. And that deeper source, I'm going to draw like this. Some kind of upwelling. It's going to give me a volcano on the surface. It's probably sampling a different part of the mantle than where the plates are moving apart. Okay? So that's the mid-ocean ridge. And that's an ocean island. Let's just call it Hawaii. Okay? So these are sampling a different portion of the mantle, perhaps, and we don't know how deep. That's a big question. That's one of our big questions that we want to answer. But we do know that when we look at the various isotopic systems, and I've really only mentioned one, that there's more variability in from island to island than there is in the mid-ocean ridges. So that's an interesting point, because it basically says that the upper part of the mantle is pretty well mixed, not perfectly mixed, but pretty well mixed. But somewhere else in the mantle, there's something else going on. So I'm going to actually, I want you to remember that point, because towards the end I'm going to show you some calculations that talk about why that might happen or what we don't understand about that. So that's something to bear in mind. Okay.
So are you saying that typical volcanism, like in the Northwest, is only
So in the Pacific Northwest, that's actually a different source of different type of volcanism. That's actually volcanism that's associated with one of these downwellings. And so I'm kind of leaving that off this picture for the moment. That sort of volcanism is associated with the downwelling coming down here, probably bringing fluids, water in there, which causes acts somehow as a flux that reduces the melting temperature and then causes melting to occur. So there's a lot happening there, and so we can't really use that directly as a sample of the mantle because it's bringing material down from the surface. It's got various things going on. We use that to study other processes, but it's not so useful as an immediate study of the sort of average interior of the Earth for that reason. How does it lead to Mount St. Helens? Let's see. We have an expert somewhere, and I won't point out the expert. That's not fair. Essentially, you mean how does melting occur at all?
Well, just how does it blow its top? It's material
going down. It's going down, and there. An aspect of that, I'm not an expert on this, but there's an aspect of this process that is bringing water or hydrated minerals into the interior. There's some steam, but there's also a matter of reducing it changes the viscosity of the magma, and also there's an aspect, it's coming through continental crust, so it's going through a lot of things, and also basically, it's melting for sort of odd reasons because it should be cold there, but it's melting because the melting temperature is being forced down in that region. So, topic for
pressure and temperature as I
go. Oh, yeah. Into the interior? Okay, orders of magnitude of pressure and temperature. So the temperatures in the interior here are in the range of sort of 1300, 1500, and then they go all the way down to 3000-ish K. in there, and we measure pressure in gigapascals, so zero near the top and hundreds near the bottom, and so that basically, you know, and then it's sort of steady in between, actually, so that gives you a sense of the pressures. Yeah,
one more question, which
sort of along the lines of the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, gosh.
Yellowstone, is there an upwelling there?
Oh, that's an interesting question. That's hypothesized by some people to be one of these hot spots. Okay, so it is thought by some folks to be one of these anomalous locations of volcanic activity, and that's actually a great source of discussion. It's harder to identify hot spots on the continents because the continents stuff has to go through. I should actually have mentioned another scale here, which is that the continental crust is something like 35 kilometers thick, and the ocean crust is something like 6 kilometers thick-ish, you know, approximately. These are variable number, but basically stuff is going through a lot more material and has a lot more to do on its way up. Estimates. You mean use? Oh, I'm not sure I know what you're asking exactly. Can you calculate that from some scale law? Not really, because the full set of chemical and sort of this full set of processes that is happening. That you can calculate. The 100 kilometers you can calculate. These are a little different. The 100 kilometers you can calculate because that's basically a hot or cold thermal boundary layer. And so what I'm leading up to, and you'll see I'm drawing these sort of circulation patterns here somehow, is that this is basically a convecting system. And essentially what's happening here is that we have a spherical shell which has a cold surface, and it's heated from within, and there's actually some heat coming out from below as well. And together, those amount to a convection system, which should set up some cells. And so, yes, you can estimate. Actually, this is a kind of beautiful calculation. You can estimate the thickness of this by looking at what happens if you bring a hot packet of material up, slap it onto a cold ocean floor, and allow it to cool. And you can estimate very well sort of the amount of heat that comes out at the mid-ocean ridges and the amount of heat that comes out as you move away from the mid-ocean ridges and the thickness of the corresponding plate. This is known as the lithosphere, the corresponding plate thickness. And it actually, that calculation goes very, very well with observations. So this is a very nicely confined and predictable sort of model.
Can you estimate of this thickness from just buoyancy?
You can.
The pressure is equal to
isostasy, probably. You can estimate sort of the depth of the crust from the elevation of the crust, and that's also quite consistent across the planet. Actually, it's consistent on other planets too, which is interesting. Other rocky planets too. So, yes. So you can estimate this from that. What I wasn't sure whether you were getting at is whether I can predict the thickness from a model of how the Earth has evolved through time. That's a little bit harder. So, okay. So, wow. Okay. Lots of things to talk about in through time. I wanted to mention that two other sort of disciplines that we bring to bear on this, and one of them is, but I'm not going to really say much about it, one of them is mineral physics, which is basically the application of condensed matter physics to these problems. In order to understand the behavior of minerals at elevated pressures and temperatures, we need to basically bring in condensed matter physicists who can do that. And there have been a lot of advances in this, both in theory, in theoretical advances, and also in experimental advances. People can now, with the right experimental apparatus, take small pieces of material all the way to the extreme pressure and temperature conditions that apply through the interior of the Earth and then make measurements on them. So that actually is very nice to be able to do. And in addition, people who think about so-called first principle calculations can, at some very small level, assemble some minerals at high pressures and temperatures and start to predict their properties. And that is extremely useful to us in understanding the various transitions that happen, because the same minerals that occur at the surface, as they undergo elevated pressures and temperatures, they change their structure. So the sort of everyday example that I typically use if I'm teaching a geology class is, coal to diamond. You have a very strong change in the properties as you increase pressure. But in addition, that happens in the interior. In fact, most of what's happening, most of the minerals in the lower mantle is a mineral structure called perovskite, which is actually somewhat important to condensed matter physicists for other purposes. So there's a lot of perovskite structured material in the interior of the Earth. Why do we want to know the structures? Well, we'd like to be able to integrate all the pieces of information. So we have seismology giving us a snapshot of the Earth, but not giving us time information, and also not a complete snapshot because of the resolution issues. We have geochemistry giving us a time-integrated picture, but again, only where we are allowed to see it by volcanic activity and process through the filter of melting that's occurred. And then we have mineral physics, which gives us some information about the structures, which then will allow us to interpret the seismic velocity variations. And all of these together start to piece together a larger picture of the interior. And then we also have dynamical modeling, which is the kind of thing that gives us the calculation of the lithospheric thickness based on heat flow kind of observations. So all of these together we have to integrate. And so this is actually one of the reasons why we like being in a place like this, where we have some time for all of these disciplines to think, to educate each other, to basically talk about what we do and don't really know, and what is fully understood and what's not so fully understood. So I want to think about this as a convection system, and pose to those who are interested in nonlinear dynamics a kind of problem that you might be curious about. So I thought it might be worthwhile just writing down the flow equations just for fun. I'll do that really quickly, because I like them. So basically, I'm treating this I'm going to treat this now as a fluid, as a very viscous fluid. And I'm going to ask myself, what are the governing equations? Well, the governing equations that we have amount to things like conservation of mass. So you asked about what goes up, what comes down. So basically, the kinds of things I want to know are, what are the rates, what are the velocities like? What's the structure of the flow? And what are the patterns of flow? So the U is here.
You wrote that first equation. How does density vary as you go toward being core?
Okay, so density increases with pressure. Where did that come from? Oh, thanks. Density increases with pressure. By a factor of about, as you go towards the core. It doesn't quite double in the mantle, and then it jumps up by a lot when you get into the core, because you change to iron, so it sort of doubles as you cross the core mantle boundary, and then increases as well with depth. I'm actually going to... No. In fact, this is actually not a correct... This is an approximation. This is not actually correct. So in fact, it's not. This only works for an incompressible fluid, and we tend to simplify the equations in order to be able to solve them, essentially. So that's one of the simplifications we make. It doesn't really make that much difference. The other thing that affects the density, though, is variations in temperature. So this is the hot material expands, cold material contracts. And that's actually a really important factor, and that only comes into play at the few percent level. So again, we neglect that in this, but it appears in another term in the equation. Okay? So I'm just going to write down the force balance equation, and hopefully that's P. Rho G. And okay, so this is equals zero. This is just a force balance equation that looks at the effect of pressure, variable pressure. Also, we have a viscous force term. So here's a viscosity. Okay, so hold on to that in your mind as a viscosity. Remember, I said this creeping flow is very, very viscous. Then we have a density term with a gravity term, and the gravity term only applies in the radial direction of the Earth. So that only appears in one of these two force balance equations. One's horizontal and one's vertical. Okay, so this viscosity is quite interesting because it's not constant. Well, first of all, it's very, very large. So I don't know what units you're used to thinking of in viscosity, but in sort of standard units, we're talking about something that is 10 to the 19th or 10 to the 21st or something like that, Pascal seconds. So it's 20 or more orders of magnitude greater than the viscosity of honey, for example, at room temperature. Okay. So that's why the flow is so slow. And that's why we can treat this as an extremely viscous fluid. Did you have a question?
Yeah, does the spin of the Earth have
no
sentient?
No, it's irrelevant. It's completely irrelevant. So there's several terms that are irrelevant. That's one of them. The spin of the Earth plays no role at all in this, essentially. It's so tiny. I don't even know how tiny it is because we just ignore it.
What about the oblation of the Earth? I mean, since it's not spherical, is that...
It doesn't. That's the kind of thing that you have to take into account when we're calculating the gravitational effect of density variations, but it's not something that affects the flow. And the same is true, you might ask whether, when I get to the energy term, whether tides are going to play a role. No, not really. They're really small by comparison. So
seismologists have to worry about them.
Yes, exactly. It's not that we don't have to worry about them, but they don't drive the flow. Yeah.
Well, aren't the time scales very different? I mean, wouldn't you average over them anyway?
Yeah, I guess you would. Yeah. Okay. So let me get to
the. Don't have time in this equation at all. That's correct.
Actually, I don't have time direct. I have time is going to enter into the velocities, so the velocities are going to change with time.
It's not obvious why it will change with time. There is no derivative with respect to time.
That's right. There's no derivative with respect to time here. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing that's not in here. There is a derivative with respect to time when it comes to the temperature equation. Oops, plus U del T. And I should also add that So I care about temperature, and temperature is actually going to feed back into this equation because my density varies with temperature. And we typically, this is a thermal expansion coefficient, a volumetric thermal expansion coefficient, and we typically, that's temperature and that's some reference temperature. We typically, this is very small, and we typically assume it's constant. It probably varies a little bit with depth, but not a huge amount. Then we have an energy, basically, balance term. And that does have a time derivative of temperature. It has an advection term, if you're familiar with that, and it has a conduction term in it. And we might also actually have a heat production term for those radioactive elements, so that would be a good term to add in there too. And so basically these are coupled in the sense that the density couples the temperature with the buoyancy force and the viscosity, which is dependent on temperature, couples the temperature with the viscous forces as well. So all of those are coupled. Yeah, that's right. Actually, he didn't know about this term either, right? So he left off this, which was very important. He also left off this. Yeah, he wouldn't have had any way of knowing that there was convection happening in the interior of the Earth. It sure seems solid, so he wouldn't have really known that. But yes, when Kelvin did the back of the envelope calculation for the age of the Earth, he guessed what the melting temperature would be, and then knew that heat was flowing out of the interior and calculated the age to be some extremely small number. 30,000 things, yeah. So, but he didn't know, although radioactivity had basically just been discovered, and so he didn't recognize that it could be a significant source term in this, and he didn't know, no one knew, that for another, many years, that for not quite a century, that this term was also important for carrying heat as well. Yeah.
How come there's no advection term in the velocity equation? Is it just small because of viscosity?
It's small because of the viscosity, yeah. So there's no. So what? One of the things I think you're sort of getting at is that there's no turbulence in the mantle, right? It's not a turbulent flow. It's essentially a laminar flow, but it is very. It does have a strong time dependence. So it's got a kind of a thermal turbulence. I've heard it called kind of informally a thermal turbulence, and. And so that's actually of interest here to us. We'd like to understand that thermal turbulence. And so there, I've left out a bunch of stuff in these equations. You already noticed that I left out compressibility. I haven't really gone into exactly what that viscosity term is, how it's actually dependent on temperature. It may also be dependent on stress, which could be a problem for us. There are various solid state phase transitions within the mantle that could have an effect. And certainly have an effect sort of locally and maybe have an effect globally as well, and I've kind of left those off of this. So when we're... surprisingly, it's not really a function of radius. That's actually an interesting thing. It's 10 pretty much everywhere because you're getting close to this enormously dense core. And so even though you're leaving behind the mantle as you go down its depth, it's remarkably uniform through the mantle. It's one of the fun things about the mantle. Yeah?
I just wanted to ask a question about what you said about no turbulence in the mantle.
Mm-hmm.
Does this mean that most of the energy, the kinetic energy, is on a 1,000-kilometer distance scale?
Yeah, maybe down to 100 kilometers scale. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's on very long time scales.
But is it known how the energy is distributed over the mantle?
Some people have looked at that a little bit, and it tends to be distributed in the long wavelength processes, and that's actually confirmed by seismic velocity variations as well. That it's.
I asked about this in the discovery of the ocean stuff 20 years ago. Most of the energy was in the smaller scale, the mesoscale.
Yeah, I don't think that's true of the mantle. So I would be very, very surprised if that were true in the mantle. So, okay, just debating how to best use the remainder of my time. Okay, so one question we have, I guess, so you can do a lot of things with these equations. You can basically start by doing a sort of simple calculation, you can normalize them. I wrote them out in sort of dimensional form. You can basically put these all in some non-dimensional terms, which makes them nicer to work with. And if you do that the way I've written them here, I've written them conveniently such that all but one of the terms drops into a single parameter called the Rayleigh number. And I'm not going to go through all of that. If you want, we can talk about it later. Okay, so basically I can non-dimensionalize all these and then get rid of most of the terms, then I'm going to be left with a heat flow Rayleigh number as well. But essentially I can reduce everything to a Rayleigh number which contains the density, the gravity force, alpha, the thermal expansion coefficient, the effective temperature, so I need to have some temperature scale, and that's likely to be the difference between the temperature in the top and the bottom of the mantle. Some length scale, which is likely to be this 3,000 kilometer length scale. The thermal diffusivity and the viscosity. Okay, so all of those together basically fold into this one dimensionless parameter, which then shows up in these sets of equations right here, actually. Shows up right there when you non-dimensionalize everything. That means normalizing the depth to the length scale to the depth and all that sort of stuff. So this basically represents all of the buoyancy forces, and it also represents the forces that are inhibiting convection. So the heat thermal conductivity is basically allowing heat to move out, and viscosity is resisting flow. And together, this gives us a kind of parameter to work with. Now, if you're familiar with, I don't know everybody's expertise in the room, so if you're familiar with fluid dynamics, you're familiar a little bit with these sorts of dimensionless numbers. The Reynolds number comes up fairly frequently, and some various other ones. This is a similar type of parameter in that it describes the onset of a behavior, and the onset of the behavior that it describes is convection. And so if I were going to take a simple model of... if I were going to basically plot heat flow out of the mantle or out of a model as a function of the Rayleigh number, what I would find is that I would end up with something that is constant at low Rayleigh number. And because basically at very low Rayleigh numbers, these buoyancy forces are small compared to the other forces, and so conduction prevails. And then I would find a sort of dramatic bifurcation at a critical Rayleigh number when convection starts. So this is a lot like the Reynolds number in the sense that the Reynolds number determines when things are turbulent. This determines when convection comes on. You don't have just a little bit of convection, or, you know, it's not a gradual transition. There's either convection or there's not convection.
How uniform do you expect that number to be spatially?
That's a really good question. This number, part of the reason I wrote the equations in this form is so that I could show you this number because it's helpful to think about the problem. But in fact, because mu here, the viscosity, is variable, and some of these others may be slightly variable as well, that this sort of analysis breaks down, or in fact we need more parameters when we start to think about the full depth dependence of the problem. Yeah?
How close does the core mantle boundary move, and how many meters per year or per minute?
Does the core mantle boundary move up or down?
Probably.
Not at all. It does. It's basic. It's pretty stationary. Yeah.
So how much is the heat flow coming out from the core into the mantle?
That's actually a somewhat of an unknown question. We know that the magnetic field is being generated there, so there has to be enough heat coming out to drive the dynamo. And at minimum, it's got to be about a terawatt. So the total heat coming out of the Earth is about 44 terawatts. And 20 of those are being generated by radioactivity. Somewhere between 1 and 10 at the other end of the scale are coming from the core. And the rest is basically cooling of the planet. The planet formed hot and is still cooling off. So basically, somewhere between, a small amount and maybe 10% or something of the heat is coming out of the core.
And the outer boundaries, is it fair to say that the continents are actually insulated?
They're like blankets. They are like blankets. They basically insulate a little bit. And in fact, there's evidence that, say, under Africa, which is a continent that's been sitting in its place for a long period of time, that the mantle has an elevated temperature as a result of that. Okay, so I just did want to get to a few sort of fun questions here. When do I need to stop? Soon. Okay. Okay. Oh, that's no problem.
How big is the Rayleigh number?
Oh, about it's. Oh, sorry. Yeah, it's in the range of maybe 10^7, 10^8, something like that. Maybe bigger. It's plenty big. So this transition happens at maybe roughly 1,000, and it's orders of magnitude bigger than that. So, and in fact, you may have other bifurcations out here, at which we get time dependence. So there's a kind of a nice 1/3 power law between this heat flow and the Rayleigh number, but 1/3 power relationship. But we may get other bifurcations. And so actually, one question that we ask: we know from geology that the Earth has changed over time, right? We know that the plates haven't been moving in exactly the same configuration. So we know that the mantle is time dependent. And so we might naturally ask the question, it's not turbulent, is it chaotic? Can we define it as being chaotic? And this is actually quite an interesting question. And it's a question that I would like to know the answer to. My thought is that yes, it probably is. So some people have done some studies along the lines of trying to treat this as a kind of nonlinear system. If you're familiar with the origin of the Lorentz equations in nonlinear dynamics, he basically was writing down equations for convection in the atmosphere and then truncating them severely to just 3 powers. And that gave him a set of ordinary differential equations, which gave rise to the classic chaos equations. If you do that with the mantle, you really don't get chaos. But if you add more terms in there, you can find chaotic behavior by doing a similar sort of analysis. So that's quite interesting to see.
What are the time scales you're trying to reproduce?
We are trying to reproduce variations on the time scale of hundreds of millions of years. Yeah. So observations don't help us that much with that. We're pretty much left to predictions.
That's the basic theory of the convection law.
Yeah, something like that. Mm-hmm. So the kinds of questions we're trying to ask are, what is the boundary layer, the unstable boundary layer, do at depth? What is the upwelling do at depth? And can we explain these sort of uniform distribution? Can we explain a mantle that's well mixed at the surface and yet somehow more heterogeneous at depth? Okay. Yeah.
So what are these mixing times?
Well, that's actually an open question. So the mixing times are in the scale of millions of, hundreds of millions of years, probably, something like that. And so so that's actually, that leads me, I was going to show you a couple of animations of this, which will sort of quickly see if this works. Well, you know, that's a kind of open question. I'm hedging because this is an active area of research. So there are sort of two points of view on this. The one point of view. So if you're familiar at all with mixing, basically the what's going to happen here? My computer's going to do something interesting. Yep. Hang on a sec while I bring this back to life. I hope. Okay, so if you're familiar with, waiting for it to wake up. If you're familiar with mixing, you know that whether you're dealing with sort of mixing in a nonlinear system, whether you're dealing with mixing in a physical system, the two aspects that you need to have mixing are you need dispersion of materials and you need folding. Okay, I'm going to try this. My computer went to sleep. It's thinking about whether to wake up again. There we go. Beautiful. Hopefully this will come to life. Okay. So I've just done a very simple calculation here. Actually, I should probably start that over again. Okay. I've done a very simple calculation here to show you how that works in a model mantle. So I've simplified this even more in the sense that I'm giving you a flat Earth. I've heated it. I've taken the assumption that the flat Earth. Oops. Well, that's never happened before. No, I have it plugged in. Oh, yeah. I've. But, and, they're really worth it. Let's see what happens. That's a good sound. That's the sound I wanted, I think. I've taken the assumption in this that the mantle is flat. I'm also actually, in this particular movie that I'm going to show you, I'm assuming that the heat flow from the core is really negligible. And since that's a subject of open discussion, it's a valid thing to think about doing.
It's 100% internal heating.
All right. There we go. Okay. Sorry?
No net temperature difference?
Well, you build up a net temperature difference because basically things heat. So the boundary condition at the top is cold. So the Earth is cooling from the top, fixed temperature. Yeah, that's actually the reasonable assumption to take.
And the bottom is adiabatic.
Yes. Yes, no flux of heat. So the gradient of temperature in the vertical direction is zero in this case. It's insulating. And
so how many years do we see there?
You're going to see about a billion years. Okay, so roughly speaking. Okay, so there was a little dot. You probably didn't notice it. There was a little dot right there at the beginning. And that was a whole lot of particles. And so I want to sort of see, that's 30,000 particles. And you're seeing them start to disperse. And you're seeing the classic mixing pattern that you would expect to see in a mixing system. You're seeing dispersion of these things. You're seeing stretching and folding. Now, ultimately, mixing, the final sort of step in mixing in a fluid ought to be molecular diffusion. That happens at such small scales in the mantle that we don't really worry about it. In our case, the particles are sort of dispersed widely enough before we ever see them. And so we get these lovely fine scale kinds these very fine scale stripes and bands and so on, and nice structures that we would like to be able to see. And in fact, what you may notice is that the mixing is actually pretty good locally, but it's not very good globally. So we're getting local mixing within a cell. So essentially what's happening is that the flow has organized itself into a series of cells, and then there's some lateral, but they're slightly time dependent, and so there's some lateral distribution across them. And just to play around with this, I thought I'd show you a this. That was kind of the base model for a series of calculations, and I want to show you an animation of something that leads to this. Now, I mentioned that viscosity varies. It varies with pressure in a way that we sort of know, but we don't have a very good, we don't have a completely perfect handle on how it varies completely with depth. And so we sort of tried out a few models in which the viscosity is constant with depth, the viscosity increases gradually with depth, and the viscosity increases abruptly with depth, and did the same thing. So what you're seeing there is the particle locations at the in the animation that you just saw, particle locations again, and then notice these nice structures that develop. So I'm going to show you a couple of animations where you can see something like that developing. Let's jump ahead here. Okay, this is a sort of another variant on the same way of visualizing these particle distributions. In this case, again, I started out with four quadrants so that I just dyed different colors, and you see the homogenization of the material is almost perfect but not completely perfect, and you get these nice banded banded formations, sort of marble cake kind of formation. Just to try something out, I increased the viscosity with depth as I thought it might be. So this F is a viscosity increase factor. And look at the difference that I get. I get these very interesting structures. So this is actually a kind of curiosity that I would like to be able to explain. This is not a phase-based plot. It's a physical space. It's a plot of the physical space that's represented by this numerical calculation. And but what I'm seeing is regions in which I have basically no mixing, and then regions in which the mixing is extremely vigorous, and we get very nice complicated structures between them. And again, you'll notice the sort of overall redness of this side and the overall blueness of this side. There's not all that much cross-exchange between these two overarching cells that develop. A curiosity of this is that you might think that these structures would become more pronounced as I increase that F factor, but they don't. So I'm going to start another movie and then answer your question. Okay, so I've now bumped this up a little bit, and just watch what happens. And yes, you had a question? I increased two things in this. I have temperature dependence in this, temperature dependence. I also increased the viscosity with depth, and I increased the thermal conductivity with depth. So both of those are things that have been proposed for the Earth, and in fact people have proposed that because of the high elevated viscosity and elevated thermal conductivity in the lower mantle, that perhaps it shuts down convection. And so these models were designed to test that assumption, that hypothesis, that idea. And in fact what we see is that they don't shut down convection at all. Instead the sort of mixing becomes confined a little bit to the upper mantle, but then the packets of material get carried into the lower mantle. So I find it sort of interesting that as I make a transition through this factor, F factor, I move from a very disorganized flow to a flow that's organized in some way, and then back to it's still an organized flow, but the resultant mixing is fairly disorganized. And this is something that I think is an interesting thing, and I'd really like to understand it a little bit better, and here's a kind of summary of that. This is my base model with nothing unusual about it, and I'm increasing that F factor. I get these lovely eyes, and then they disappear when I move to higher values. The F factor is the increase in viscosity and also in the rate of thermal diffusivity. So I'm basically allowing, it's both of the things that were in the bottom of the Rayleigh number. I'm basically trying to suppress convection as much as possible. Someone else have a question?
Are you only really getting one downwelling, or is that an artifact of how you set up the initial?
That's basically a geometry thing. That's because of the geometry of that flow, that I'm only getting a single down. There were multiple downwellings. Essentially, by changing these parameters, I basically force some of the power into the lower, longer wavelengths, and so essentially what happens is that the flow tends to organize itself into a somewhat more organized flow with small-scale variations in it. And if I were doing the full spherical convection pattern, I don't know if that would happen in quite the same way, although I expect something like it might happen. And there I'm just restricted by essentially computer power effectively, and also the ability to process the data. So I just wanted to show, because I think it's sort of an interesting an interesting approach to analyzing this sort of thing. This is some work that was done in France, and they did a very simple box model in 3D, just to show you what happens in 3D, where they drove this by some plate motion. So they're not solving the full convection equations; they're solving just the force balance part of it, and not the temperature part. And they introduced some particles in here, and they found that even in 3D, they could see a sort of chaotic flow and a stable flow at the same time, which was quite interesting. And they actually analyzed that by using a Poincaré section. Again, we're dealing with a physical space here, not a phase space. So they basically took a slice through the middle here and mapped out where a single particle, and the red is a single particle, and how it had sliced through with time. And they did this for a variety of different models. And then they actually calculated, they decided that the way to approach this was as a classical kind of dynamical system, and calculate a stretching rate, which they termed the Lyapunov exponent, and that allowed them to see, so the red stuff is where the Lyapunov exponent is very large, and the blue and purple are where it's small, and that allowed them to map out the regions of mixing and non-mixing. So our question actually for us is, there's several questions. First of all, how do we really understand, these are very small variations in a model which give rise to huge variations in the mixing and stretching. And also, they don't quite produce the patterns that we see in the geochemistry. And so they produce something that is kind of evocative of what we see in the geochemistry. So we have sort of several major questions. One is, how do we then use this sort of approach to apply to our geological observations with all of their kind of various strengths and limitations? And second of all, how do we then fully understand the dynamics of systems like this when we are, you know, simplified systems like this, and how they behave, what controls exactly the behavior of a system like this? So I thought I would sort of leave you with that and say that basically we're spending a fair amount of time, not so much on this particular thing, but on various aspects of this problem here, to try and understand what these different what controls the flow and how we would observe it from our various geological, geochemical, geophysical observations. So thanks for your attention, and if you have any more questions, I'll just... Well, so in these particular ones, the hot spots would be the corresponding upwellings. And in this particular one, there are no hot spots because I've eliminated all the heat flow from the base of the mantle. So the hot spots are very interesting to us because they produce such, you know, fantastically beautiful features on the surface, and also because they carry these geochemical sort of characteristics of interest. But in terms of the energy of the overall system, they're pretty negligible. They're maybe 10% of the energy of the system. So we're interested in them as a phenomenon, but they don't drive the flow. And so if I had heated this from below, you would see a corresponding set of upwellings that would be the hot spots. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I thought at one stage you were about to say you could do a linear stability analysis to say something about distances between these regions, but then
Yes, you can. Actually, a linear stability analysis of these equations does give you a characteristic kind of wavelength of the flow, and it does correspond to the plate. The thing is that plates are the kind of surface structure, and they vary from small to quite large. But but there's some consistency.
Correspond to anything that's observable?
It probably corresponds to sort of the longer of the plate sizes. And I think the thing is that what controls the plate sizes probably is processes at the surface more than the underlying plates, because they do behave more as elastic plates on the surface. So even though I consider them to be the cold thermal boundary layer, there are things that cause them to break at certain wavelengths and so on that are maybe less well understood. Yeah.
I'm just clicking the channels on TV. And this program was talking about mega hotspots.
Oh, yeah, mega plumes or something, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Giant volcanoes.
Yeah,
yeah, super. In the simulations? Well, in this particular simulation, I don't really have the hotspot, so no. There are evidence for large-scale structures in the base of the Earth. There's one under Africa and one under the Pacific. And I probably even have a picture of it. There. Oh, look at that. So this is a slightly cartoony model of these. So just to get you oriented, here's a map that we're basically looking at the Earth as a box. Okay, this isn't really directly related to the thing, but it's a picture anyway that tells you about the structure. The green pins are the hot spots. So they're the locations of the hotspots, and there's some argument about whether some of these are really hotspots or not. And the seismic velocity variations, what you're looking at is in the lowermost mantle, so the depth is 1,500 down to the core mantle boundary. The red stuff is seismically slow. It's the speed of the seismic waves is depressed there, and the blue stuff is seismically fast by, you know, not even a percent. So these are very small scale variations that we're looking at. And there's sort of a contour here. So what you're looking at is at the lowermost mantle. And you'll notice that under Africa, there's a very large red blob. And under the Pacific, there's a very large red blob. And then around sort of the Pacific Rim, I guess, there's somewhat of a bluish structure. And so that could possibly be associated with the subducting slabs. And this is associated, perhaps, with these upwellings. So, yeah.
In Missouri, it's supposedly the site of a major earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of structure along the ground is that associated?
I don't really know much about that, but the question of why there are large earthquakes within the interior of a plate is, again, an interesting question to ask. And it probably has to do with some pre-existing structure there that then gets reactivated from time to time. Would that be a fair statement about it, Barbara?
A rift zone.
A rift zone that then has been sort of glued together, but imperfectly, and creates a kind of weak zone. So as the stresses in the crust build up, that you can get earthquakes in those locations. Those are real curiosities as well.
Well, the assumption of the basic zero order assumption of plate tectonics is that the plates are completely rigid,
right,
that you transmit stresses,
right,
uniformly. But in practice,
there are all these things. Right. So in practice, that we think of the plates as being elastic plates on the surface, and they shouldn't deform at all inside in the interior. But we know we have mountain belts, and we have volcanoes, and we have earthquakes and stuff, but not as extensively as they are near the plate boundary.
When asteroid impacts, say the size of the one in the upper pin, do
you think it's all? You know, from time to time, that idea gets proposed, and it gets proposed perhaps as an origin of some of these hot spots. Energetically, I don't think it's enough to really do that. Yeah.
2,900 kilometers.
Yeah, the question is if things... The thing is, I don't think you need to invoke it, because I think the system is so kind of unstable anyway that we get all sorts of interesting time dependence without having to use that. And so from, I guess, maybe an aesthetic point of view, I don't like that idea so much. Well, they're not. They are soft, okay, but remember, they're still solid until you get up near to the surface. So basically, they behave in the same way. They tend to be narrow enough structures that they are hard to see with the resolution of seismology as currently available. So these structures are probably 100 kilometers, whoops, sorry about that, 100 kilometers across or so, according to the models, and they're narrow. And so there are a variety of sort of technical barriers, not the least of which is basically just that it's hard to see something small in a very big Earth when you don't have sort of absolutely perfect coverage. So. How is this map made? Okay, so the structures in the lower mantle there are very well, are starting to come into focus. I think it would be fair to say there was a seismic array deployed in South Africa. When was that? That's where most of this data comes from, right?
This is a map which was obtained globally.
Right.
This global tomographic inversion, imaging, global imaging of seismic waves.
the hot spots themselves are identified by where there are volcanoes on the surface that you don't expect them. And then the width of the pin is basically supposed to represent something about how much material is coming up, and that is obtained by looking at things like the deflection of the plate upward by the upward buoyancy. And so there's some estimates made of that sort. So we had several questions. Okay, I'll tell you first.
What's the inside of the crystals?
Oh, that's a really good question. That's a really good question because it actually affects the rheology significantly. I don't know. I wouldn't presume to know what the size of the crystals are. But they could be really larger.
Right.
Like meters, I suppose. Yeah. They could be very tiny. Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're still. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Do you want to answer that? How do you estimate the errors in the inversion?
I mean, there's many sources of errors. One of them is the theoretical errors of how you just calculate wave propagation. There are other errors due to sampling. We have uneven sampling of the Earth, so that's another source of error. Mm-hmm. And then we have parametrization, which is not necessarily appropriate.
Yeah.
So the only way to really estimate errors is by bootstrapping. People do bootstrapping
This has been actually a source of discussion, I'd say, through all this meeting in a way and as elsewhere as well. Yeah. But yes, those are robust. Yeah.
I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit more on why you say that the convection in the mantle is not turbulent.
Okay, well, I guess in a technical sense, the Reynolds number is extremely small, essentially zero, because the viscosity is so high that the Reynolds numbers are very small. And so essentially you do not get the sort of cascade. I mean, I think of turbulence as being the cascade of energy from large eddies to smaller eddies and so on. And you don't really get that same thing. But you do, as you saw, get some vorticity, and you get essentially different scales of flow that are somewhat limited at the small end by the viscosity and also by the thermal diffusion.
I guess we don't really have a unique definition of what turbulence.
Right.
I would be inclined to say you certainly have positive Lyapunov exponents.
Yes. Yes.
And then you ask yourself, is it chaos?
Mm-hmm.
If it's not chaos, then I would say it's turbulence. And it's chaos only if it has a low-dimensional attractor, and I doubt very much that it does.
Why would you doubt that it has a low-dimensional attractor when it's such a highly viscous system? And it does show evidence for these very long wavelength phenomenon, so why would it not have a... I don't know the answer to that myself, but I'm curious about why it should be expected to have a low order.
Well, I'm prejudiced because when we do experiments on turbulent Rayleigh Bénard convection in the laboratory,
uh-huh.
and we are at Rayleigh numbers of 10 to the 8,
yeah.
we certainly think that our system is turbulent even at high Prandtl numbers.
Right. So what do you mean by high Prandtl number?
Well, it doesn't really matter once you're above 100 or so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Prandtl number dependence in these systems is gone once you reach Prandtl number somewhere between 10 and 10 squared.
Okay, so we're really talking about Prandtl numbers of a million to a billion, essentially.
But things go as monocoque Prandtl.
Yeah, that's right. And so once you drop that term out, it does change. And so I guess this might be a matter of semantics, essentially, of the definition. But I wanted to emphasize the extreme high viscosity and high, you know, essentially the effect of that on this. Yeah.
Just a question. You were talking, I mean, these Grok's eddies have time scales of, you were saying, 100 to millions of years.
Yes.
Are there any signatures at shorter time scales of the process?
Oh, there are processes at shorter time scales. The processes of of solid-state phase transitions and the processes of melting that occur near the surface are much shorter time scales, and the process of melt extraction is a much shorter time scale as well.
So, I think you can just maybe you've heard it in a few other time scales, like the other name here is 10 million or something.
Okay, so so basically, okay, so the Earth is 4.5 billion years. So, and then and it's been that basic structure for the whole time with the core, so the core formation doesn't really come into play. So, so the you know, the process of moving a plate around is in the range of any of the processes of plate tectonics, sort of moving plates around, moving subduction, moving a plume, a blob of plume stuff from the core mantle boundary to the surface is probably in the tens of millions of years, basically. So those are the processes that we're primarily interested in. The processes that happened at much shorter time scales are things like melting, which can happen at the, I suppose, hundreds to thousands of years time scale or smaller. The processes of phase, solid-state phase transition, when something moves through through a transition, it's going to happen presumably instantly, although maybe not exactly instantly. And those processes also happen on link scales that are quite small, so the scale of centimeters to tens of meters, something like that, as opposed to these scales hundreds to thousands of kilometers. So that's something that come into play. The process of earthquakes happens on a very, very small scale, and the time scale for the elastic wave energy to go through the mantle is on the order of, you know, seconds, hours, minutes, days. So those processes, and there are earthquakes in the interior, in the deep interior. So the Sumatra earthquake, for example, is associated with one of these subduction zones. And those earthquakes do to go down to about 700 kilometers, and then they stop happening. And those but the earthquakes themselves happen on an earthquake time scale very fast.
Yeah. Are there any geophysical signatures of things like the Earth's changing magnetic field?
The magnetic field is moving. So the magnetic field is changing on a very rapid time scale, or it can change on a very rapid time scale. So when it reverses, you know, this is actually capturing a reversal is somewhat difficult, but it's changing. It's currently changing on a scale that is measurable by humans, so by satellite observation. So the Earth's magnetic field intensity is changing on the scale of you know, years, decades, and so on. And also you can map the evolution of the magnetic field through hundreds of years by looking at historical records, navigation records. So it's been evolving on the time scale of hundreds of years, and then it also evolves on the time scale of tens of millions and hundreds of millions of years as well. It evolves on the magnetic field evolves on all time scales, actually.
What are the magnitudes of U
and velocity? The magnitudes of U are centimeters per year. So if you like,
in the mantle
probably as well. So that's the rate at which your fingernails grow, if you like that kind of analogy, just to tie it to a human scale.
Yeah, and it does not know how good is this model. I mean, you've taken a purely viscous free.
Uh-huh.
That's viscoelastic.
Oh, well, okay. So we know that at some time scale, at the earthquake time scale, things are behaving elastically because elastic waves propagate through. Okay, and we know that at the surface that the sort of plates behave in an elastic way and they bend like an elastic plate and they do all sorts of things that are predictable as an elastic plate. The interior, we have a very good handle on the fact that it behaves in this viscous way. The rheology, the specifics of the rheology, how it depends on pressure and temperature and stress and so on, is a source of active study. And that's probably, in a way, one of the more interesting aspects of this is figuring out that term and how that depends on all sorts of things. It's hard to measure in the lab. I think it's all a matter of time scales. It's all a matter of time scales. On the very long time scales, I mean, the way we know the viscosity is by looking, you know, the sort of first measurements of the viscosity or early measurements of the viscosity were made by looking at how the crust rebounded after glaciers withdrew after the last ice age, and it rebounds in a way that's very nicely predictable as a viscous material. So there's some really some very robust observations that tell us what the viscosity is. Yeah.
Getting to your movie, is it reasonable to interpret the distance between these downdrafts in the movie with a plate?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It is reasonable to do that. And, oops, okay.
Because then the movie showed that the plates can reconfigure.
Yes, they do. And they do. So what you're not seeing necessarily or noticing necessarily is that these things are going straight down and they're merging in this way. That probably doesn't happen quite like that in the mantle. And that's because I in this model, I'm sure I don't have the rheology right.
Do you have the crust as a boundary condition?
I have the surface as a temperature boundary condition. So I'm cooling the earth at the surface as I ought to be. It's basically just losing heat to space in a sort of reasonable, realistic way. I'm not too worried about that particular boundary condition. I'm much more worried about the rheology as being a controlling factor on this.
What's the last question? Well, I might think it'd be nice to, maybe you write down the fundamental equation.
Sure.
Really what's happening microscopically,
right? Yeah.
Grand challenge, but then you would like to derive this.
Yes.
Right, but if I do that for a solid, creep in solid, you do not model like this.
Right, that's right, because you don't really have time scales like that.
Great, so wonderful. On some time scale, I'm going to be able to do creep in solids like this.
Yes.
So then I would like to know how does this time scale. So, for example, let me ask you a question. I produce a nanocrystalline material instead of a millimeter or meter scale. Then how big of an experimental should I set up? Can I do an experiment on Earth where I should expect then the creep to be reproduced by this?
Nanocrystal scale. Okay, so I would say no one's thinking about that. No one's thinking about doing a scaled experiment that has a full creeping rheology in a crystalline structure. There are people, I think there may be a very, very long time scale creep experiment somewhere, but a career-long creep experiment on some.
It still has to come out to be able to be defined at some point.
Yes.
The underlying, but if it was a single crystal, certainly you couldn't write this.
No, you couldn't. That's right.
Polycrystalline.
Yeah, that's right.
And then most of the creep occurs at grain boundary, and then that sets already a scale, which is why I asked about the grain size.
Yeah. Okay, so divide a meter into 3,000 kilometers if you want to scale it exactly, then there you go. But whether that would work exactly like that, I'm not sure. It works on the long time scales, in part because it works empirically. But
And then when you do that, using reasonable numbers, you get back a viscosity that is similar to the viscosity estimated for the rebound measurement. So those two things come together.
Yeah, and
gives us some.
In the laboratory experiments, what is being done on height strain, right? You
have a sample in the lab, you apply a differential strap. And then you measure both the strain rate and the stress. And then you do that for several different temperatures and pressures for different grain sizes. And you can map out where you have deformation that is grain size dependent, limited by the diffusion rate, versus whether it's limited by dislocation.
Mm-hmm. But don't forget that this also gives us, this sort of approach also gives us other independent outcomes that are consistent with the Earth. So we do get the boundary layer thickness that's the right thickness. We get the time scales for convection that are right. We get the heat flow out of the Earth that's approximately right. So all of those things actually, and they're all independent of each other. So that's it's a consistent model. just wanted to make sure that I was understood. All right, well, thanks for your attention. Oh, thanks.